Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.
Welcome back to Current States. We're glad you're here. I'm Mark Bayshore on 90.5 WKAR. And WKAR Scott Pohl is the envy of the staff today. He's going to the game. Must be nice. Nice work if you can find it. Have fun, Scott. Spartans versus the Crusaders of Valparaiso at the Palace of Auburn Hills. Go green. Say it. Okay, there. I heard it the second time. Well done. Police and firefighters in the city of Lansing are under pressure to make concessions to improve the city's short- and long-term budget woes. Last week, a long-awaited report from the city's Blue Ribbon Financial Health Team called for $1 million to be cut from the police department's budget. And here to discuss the issue is the president of the Lansing Fraternal Order of Police, the Police Officers and Supervisors Union, Tom Krug. Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
And from the city of Lansing, Chief Operating Officer and Director of Public Service, Chad Gamble. Chad, nice to see you.
Mark, good to see you.
Tom Krug, what do you make of the financial health team's recommendation of a $1 million budget reduction for Lansing Police?
Well, at this point, I don't know where we're going to come up with $1 million out of the police budget. The police officers over the last several years have given concessions since 2009. $2.48 million in concessions. There's just no more concessions to give. I think part of the study brought out some good points that they need to make part of the city, the cemeteries, the golf courses, and so forth, self-sufficient. But as far as the police department, they've lost 65 positions in the last few years that they haven't filled. They're at their all-time low as far as staffing. And we feel the staffing can't go any lower than it is now. And at this point, we don't see where we can come up with $1 million out of the pockets of the men and the women of the Lansing Police Department.
You told the Lansing State Journal a few days ago, quote, "There is no fat in the police budget," unquote. So impossible and inappropriate.
Well, there just is no more fat. Like I say, when you've lost that many positions, they're down to where they're going from call to call. And they're a reactive police department, and we can't go any lower. We've given concessions. We've made changes in health care. We've went to three-tier drug plans. We've got premium share for drug care. I mean, we have given. And at this point, we don't see that we have $1 million that they can pull out of that budget without cutting personnel.
Chad Gamble, what do you make of those figures? Since 2009, $2.48 million in cuts. Where did those come from, by the way? Was that two years, health care?
Well, there's two things. In 2 years, there were no salary increases at all. We took no salary increases in 8 and 9. In 2010, we went to 12-hour shifts that reduced the overtime greatly at the Lansing Police Department. That had been a big override in the budget. We've worked with the courts to, again, cut back on the overtime and the officers standing around waiting to go to court on tickets, made changes to our contract to allow those changes.
Is not taking a raise the same as a cut, in
your
view?
Well, back in 09, yes. When people were still getting raises, that was the first thing we did. But then again, we went to 12-hour shifts. We gave up promotional processes. For a period of time, we froze holiday pay where we didn't get extra pay to work a holiday. We made changes in health care where you no longer get health care if you retire at 15 years, but you have to work there for 25 years. So, I mean, there's been all kinds of changes, including going to PHP as the base plan, a much cheaper plan than the Blue Cross plan at the city.
Okay, Chad Gamble, why don't you join the conversation here? $2.48 million in sacrifices since 09, 65 fewer positions, an all-time low. Give us your perspective.
Well, first, let me just say that I think the city of Lansing and the whole Lansing region is really blessed by having a great police department. It's highly trained. It's led by a great police chief, Teresa Szymanski, and they do an excellent job of protecting the public safety in and around the region. That having been said, I think from the city's perspective, the police department's budget makes up roughly 30% of the city's general fund budget. And that large of a budget is wholly a challenge for the city to try and solve citywide. The city over the past 8 or 9 years has reduced the city's budget by deficits over $60 million. And certainly the police department and the police unions have offered concessions. One of the things that we are hoping that the unions will do, as other unions and other city staffers have done, is continue those concessions by way of not reducing the number of police officers that are on the ground, but by tweaking and changing the health care, for example, of going to a deductible plan. The Teamsters have gone to that. The non-bargaining units have gone over there. And the UAW is moving over to that area. And by the end of this year, we're hopeful that the IAFF, International Association of Firefighters, will be there. And we're hoping that the police department will also go to that plan. That will allow the city to bid out these benefits and hopefully over the years continue to maintain those at current costs or even improve those.
You're talking about consolidating the number of health plans that are available to police? Is that part of this?
That's correct. Not only just police, but the entire employees of the city of Lansing. We have over 30 active plans, 30 different active plans. So if we can continue to consolidate those plans to one or two, we can then go out to the McLarens, to the PHPs, to the Blues and say, this is a plan that we have, the entire city of Lansing employees, or even broaden that perspective from a statewide consortium, join different groups, continue to maintain the hardworking, dedicated police men and women that we have, and tweak their health care plan. For example, that would not change the number of people that we have, and then bring them over to the health care plans that many, many other city employees have already conceded that it is in the best interest of the city, it's in the best interest of their unions, and we'll go towards setting up the city for a grand future.
Does this boil down to finding $1 million or finding significant savings, we'll say? Let's leave the $1 million figure out of this for a second. Does this boil down to finding significant savings then, or reducing the number of police officers on the staff? Chad?
The city as a whole has to try and close budget gaps. We have to try and address a $600 million long-term liability issue. $600 million in long-term unfunded liabilities that we have to try and solve that will keep this city well-placed in the economic environment, keeping companies coming to the city as we have done, as Mayor Virg Marinaro has been able to do over the past couple years. We need to continue that. That is, these concessions, all of the unions and city departments working together to try and come together, for example, on this healthcare plan, will be, I think, one of the key issues in trying to solve these budget challenges for the city.
Now, how much? Have you looked at this closely enough to estimate how much of a savings the city would realize with this consolidation of health plans and these health reforms that you're talking about? I mean, how close to $1 million does that come?
We'd be very close. Very close.
Tom Krug, you led me to believe a minute ago this process has started. You have started tweaking health benefits, retiree health plans, and
correct,
that kind of thing.
Correct.
But you're maintaining everything that can be done has been done?
I'm not saying that everything that can be done has been done, but we have made big steps in changing our health care plan to a way more affordable PHP plan than some of the Blue Cross plans that they've had. The changes that we've made over the years, some of the other unions are now just catching up to some of the things we've already done. We changed to the base PHP plan a couple years ago. And again, I don't think that we're going to be able to solve the city's budget by changing health care plans. And I was told yesterday, the financial team said that we're going to give them $1 million or they're going to lay off 10 police officers. That came out yesterday afternoon. The city passed a millage a couple years ago to keep the police department at the numbers that they were 2 years ago. So I guess I don't know if they're going to renege on that promise, give the millage money back. But the Lansing Police Department can't cut any more people and serve the public at the rate that they are today.
Chad Gamble, do you know anything about this $10 million thing?
Well, the $1 million.
$1 million
was something that was said, and the general equivalent is $100,000 per officer is the rough cost. And I think someone said that that's roughly equated to that. We feel that via numbers, the city is very right-sized from a police department standpoint. And we believe also, as the other unions have done, that moving over to this new health care plan is something that would allow not to solve the entire city budget woes, but also recognize that each department, each union has the ability to help in solving that budget gap. We're not laying the entire budget on any one department. We are a team, we are a city, and the health and the ability for City Hall to work together does roll out and speaks to the city, how great it is, how cooperative we are, and our ability to attract residents, which will then allow the city to prosper and bloom.
Where did this $100,000 per officer comment come from? Can you say? Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay. Tom, Krug,
no,
do you know?
That's a figure that's been kicked around. I think it's high. When you see that high of a figure, police officers don't make $100,000, even including their benefits and future retirements and so forth. I think sometimes people throw in the cost of a car and how much gas they use and the office space that they need, which really isn't an employee cost. But, I mean, I've heard that number kicked around before. I think the actual cost of a police officer is a lot less than that. Some of the things in the study we agree with.
Tom, are you talking with or meeting with the Brunero administration?
They have not asked us for any input at all.
Okay. What's the future of that, Chad?
Well, we will be meeting. We have met with union members several weeks ago. I hadn't met them recently, and we sat down and had a very good conversation about what lies ahead in the city's future, the opportunities that I think we all have to act as a team to try and move the city forward. And it was an excellent conversation, and I look forward to more conversations just like that.
Tom, what kinds of things are your members saying? What kinds of things are you hearing from them?
I think, again, since this layoff rumor started again yesterday from a quote from Mr. Hollister, morale's down. I think they also agreed that there isn't $1 million to give. Though the study has some good ideas in it, I think one of the ideas, instead of selling City Hall, is move your police department back to City Hall. They were there years ago when they were much larger. It'll fit them all in there and quit paying rent for their precinct. Might be a first start. Spending $200,000 for more studies to study more studies is part of the studies I've...
I wish we had time to get into that whole...
But those are the things that I think before you start cutting police officers, they need to look at other things they can do in the city.
We've got to leave it there. Tom Krug is the president of the Lansing Fraternal Order of Police, the Police Officers and Supervisors Union. Chad Gamble is the Chief Operating Officer and Director of Public Service for the City of Lansing. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. Nick Garris has performed traditional Irish dance and the dances of the Irish diaspora around the world, but for Nick, his performances are not just visual expressions, but audible ones, the body in motion as music. Nick holds degrees in anthropology and music from Central Michigan University and recently completed his MA in ethnochoreology.
That's right, very good.
At the I even practiced that, and that was from the University of Limerick. This week, Nick is the artist in residence at the Residential College in Arts and Humanities at Michigan State University, and today he joins us to discuss his research, including percussive dance, cultural identity in relation to traditional dance and music, and the experiences of sexual minorities within traditional dance. Welcome to Current State.
Good morning.
Nice to meet you. How did you get into the world of dance?
Well, my parents actually made me start dancing because they said that I needed more exercise when I was 8 years old. And after a semester of tap dancing, I was exposed to Southern Appalachian music and dance. Dance from Western North Carolina, East Tennessee, the flat footing and clogging traditions that go along with the fiddle music there.
Okay.
And that sort of led to an exploration of the remarkable concurrent existence of different percussive dance traditions throughout the world. So dance traditions from Spain and from Hungary and South Africa, all of these dance traditions that have as their impetus the rhythm making with the body.
Gotcha. You are also a scholar. You study ethnochoreology.
Is that
the anthropology of dance?
Exactly.
Okay. And how did you get from performance into the research? Was it very organic, natural kind of transition, or what?
Well, at Central Michigan University, while I was doing my undergrad, I was encouraged by a professor to maybe look into sort of the more ethnological aspects of my own artistic practice. And in doing that, he really encouraged me to take some anthropology classes. So anthropology introduced me to the premise of using field work, using long-form interview and talking to exponents of traditions as a way of getting inside a particular culture. And so that's kind of what led to ethnochoreology. Through my own dance practice and then looking at dance traditions in their own cultural context, and then trying out those dances on the body.
That is one heck of a word. Ethnochoreology. That is a 21st century word, right?
That's great. My parents think I'm in medical school.
He's a PhD in ethnochoreology.
That's right.
Well, tell us a little bit more about percussive dancing. I mean, you think tap dance, the sound that emanates from people dancing, correct?
Exactly, okay. Exactly. So whether artists are making contact with their hands on the body or the contact of the feet on the floor, there's an incredible wide purview of many different percussive dance styles. So there's dance traditions like this from India and dance traditions from South Africa in which miners made contact with their hands on their boots, or tap dancing like we have in the United States, or Irish step dancing that came out of the rhythmic knocking of the feet against the floor.
Interesting. Now, your studies of dance led you to Ireland, and while you were there, you began to research sexual minorities within the Irish step dancing communities. Tell us about that.
That's right. Well, from my own experience here in the United States in the folk scene, I think I was really intrigued when I began meeting a lot of GLTBQ Irish dancers, gay, lesbian, bi, and trans Irish dancers.
Okay.
And really thinking about the discourse around American traditional music and dance in this country, those art forms are often construed with ideologies of rurality, agrarian life, home and family, things that for some reason in our culture are construed as mutually exclusive from any sort of queer perspective. And when I went to Ireland, I kept meeting a lot of musicians and dancers who said, I have to talk to you about something. So, and it was the intersection of their sexual identity, their nationality, and their own artistic practice that I found so so interesting and captivating.
How often did that happen? Someone comes and say, and I have to talk to you about this because...
I'm not certain. Well, it happened...
That happened several times, you're saying?
Within my first few weeks of doing my master's in Ireland, I was approached on several occasions, and maybe it's because I'm a queer subject myself, sort of opening the door to those kinds of conversations. So when I began having these chats with people, I immediately was sparked by questions about minority status and traditional dance. Traditional dance, which is often appropriated by government regimes and for nationalist ideology throughout history as a way of representing the nation to itself.
Now, as an anthropology scholar, you not only collected ethnographic research, but you also looked for historical precedents that expressed alternative sexual identities within the tradition. Some of your examples you found were in music, and we're about to play one example. The song The Dark Slender Boy is one of them. Here it is. So what do you hear there, Nick? Tell us.
That song, An Buachaill Coil Dubh, which in the Irish language translates to The Dark Slender Boy, is a song that a lot of music scholars find allegorical in some way. It's either talking about a pint of Guinness, right, the dark slender boy, or it's talking about maybe a same-sex attraction between a singer and a young man. And I've been in situations where both of those allegories have been used and where singers of alternative sexual preference have sort of used that as a very subtle way to express their own sexual identity in a way that was socially acceptable.
Well, historically, though, what do you think?
I think that traditional music and dance has been used by people for a lot of different ways.
No, I mean about that particular song, though. I mean, was it referring to sexuality way back when? How old is that song? Do we know?
I think that song dates to the beginning of the last century. So, but the interesting thing about traditional music is that people use it today, even still, as a way of expressing their identity. So whether it initially was about someone who had an attraction to a young man, and whether it's being used as such now, are two very different questions. So I actually see that people who are involved in traditional music and dance, it's interesting to see them use traditional music and dance as a way of expressing the subtleties of their own identity.
Now, in looking back through these traditions and searching for evidence of non-heterosexual perspective, did you ever feel as though homosexuals had been written out of history? And do you feel that through your work, you're writing them back in?
Well, certainly as a queer subject myself, creating work and being interested in working in traditional art forms, whether it's American clogging or fiddle music and step dance from Quebec or in Irish music, I think we're making new paths and helping maybe to expand the mindset a little bit so that queerness and alternative sexual preference aren't necessarily mutually exclusive from ideas about fiddle music, dancing, and those kind of community expressions.
Now, you're also a singer, as it turns out.
That's correct.
And when you sing these traditional songs, you will sometimes switch around the pronouns. So rather than singing about a boy and a girl, you're sometimes singing about two boys. What does including or incorporating a perspective beyond the typical heterosexual one, what does that do for you as an artist and for your audience when you're singing?
That's sort of exactly what I'm talking about at the crux, the intersection of my own identity and my artistic practice. In doing that, it's sort of like a small way of creating a little bit of an activist statement, but using traditional mediums like traditional song, traditional dance, and fiddle tunes, whether it be from this country or from Ireland, as a way of expressing my own take on the world and my own experience.
Nick Garris is a dancer and a singer and has his master's in ethnochoreology, which he received from the University of Limerick. And this week, Nick is the artist in residence at the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities at Michigan State University. He has studied percussive dance, performs percussive dance, cultural identity in relation to traditional dance and music, and the experience of sexual minorities within traditional dance. Really interesting discussion. Thank you, Nick, very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Good luck to you. Coming up on Current State, if you've got a thing about germs, we've got the segment for you, Superbugs. An MSU epidemiologist dishes on drug-resistant bacteria. Shannon Manning joins us in just a few minutes, and we also visit the 51st Ann Arbor Film Festival. Those are coming up. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to Current State. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Today in East Lansing, advocates of early childhood education unveil scholarships for infants and toddlers. The Detroit Free Press reports 200 low-income infants and toddlers in Michigan will be receiving them. The Early Start Scholarship Program is announced today here in East Lansing. This is geared to low-income families. A family of four must make between $28,400 and $41,000 a year to qualify. A family can receive 40% of the annual cost of child care and early ed for one child, up to a maximum of $2,880 a year. This is for kids two and younger. I cannot get over the momentum over early childhood and what appears to be a consensus over it, which is refreshing. These days, media reports about some sort of new deadly bacteria appear with seemingly more regularity. We've all seen it. The doomsday headline about some bacterial infection somewhere that has no cure or is resistant to antibiotics, or worse, it eats your flesh. But has there really been a spike in these so-called superbugs, or is this just the media's way of getting you to turn the page or stay through the commercial break? Well, here to help sort this all out, MSU molecular biologist Shannon Manning. Dr. Manning played a crucial role in helping to solve the mystery behind one of the most deadly E. coli outbreaks ever, which killed more than 50 people and sickened nearly 4,000 in Germany 2 years ago. She's also a featured lecturer in MSU's Classes Without Quizzes, which we're going to learn about in just a few minutes. That's hosted by the College of Natural Science. Welcome, Shannon. Nice to meet you.
Thank you. You too.
So we keep hearing about all these super bugs these days, antibiotic-resistant bacteria that shut down your heart or ruin your digestive tract. Is this really a phenomenon? Are there more dangerous drug-resistant bacteria emerging? Or is this overreaction by folks like us in the media who are just looking to keep people from changing channels?
Well, I do think that we are seeing the emergence of many new infections, but each time we see a new infection emerge, we actually learn a lot about those infections. So I'm not sure that we should be scared. We should probably be cautious and be educated, particularly if a given infection is in a food source that you eat frequently.
Part of this seems to be that bacteria, correct me if I'm wrong, but are bacteria evolving? I do hear about that. I do read about that. Is that at the heart of this?
They are. They are. Microbes are everywhere, and they're constantly changing. And so this is kind of the basis for the flu vaccine that we get every year. And this is the reason why we have to change it, because the influenza virus evolves. And so that's true for bacteria as well. And so bacteria mutate, but they also acquire DNA from different species. And so sometimes they can acquire plasmids or other types of DNA elements that might make them resistant to the drugs that we're using to treat them. And in some cases, they can acquire DNA that will make them more virulent.
They acquire DNA.
Right. Okay. They do this naturally in the environment.
And that is at the heart of this process.
Yes.
You played a role in one example where drug-resistant bacteria was causing a great deal of fear across Europe. We don't want to make too light of this. The 2011 outbreak in Germany, this was a strain of E. coli that killed more than 50 people and sickened nearly 4,000. Tell us about that.
Okay, so the organism produces a toxin. It's called the chigatoxin. And after it attaches to the intestines, it produces the toxin that enters the bloodstream and travels to the kidney, where it causes damage, and it can cause kidney failure and death in many. And so different organisms have kind of different abilities to produce this toxin. And so what we found for this organism after I received it at MSU was that it actually forms a biofilm in the intestines. And what that means is it's a bunch of bacteria that kind of clump together, and they form a protective coating. They secrete a substance, and that it actually encases them. And this protects them from external stresses and antibiotics and such, anything that we would throw at them. But while they're actually surviving within this biofilm, we found that they're producing more toxin. Ugh. And so the extra toxin production is what we think is responsible for causing the kidney failure and the high frequencies that we saw during this outbreak.
So the evolution of this biofilm is definitely a challenge for health officials, correct? Because this is what's making it more resistant.
Right. And so this, yes, biofilms are naturally resistant to antibiotics as well. But the organism also has other DNA elements that it acquired from other bacteria that also facilitate antibiotic resistance. So it has kind of two different pieces to it.
That sounds fairly alarming.
It is.
There was a woman from Michigan who came back from visiting Germany and was severely ill, and I understand that's how you became involved. Tell us about that.
Yes, so I wasn't really involved in the outbreak investigations in Germany, but when I was here, I worked very closely with the Michigan Department of Community Health, and they alerted me that we had a case. And so we got the organism from them, and we did some tests, and that was what we found. We found that the organism produces this biofilm that makes it kind of safe within the host and produces more toxin.
And that discovery was made here at Michigan State?
Yes.
That's what you're saying? You had journalists from all over the world calling you. What was that experience like? What did they want to know?
Well, that was interesting. I think most of them wanted me to create panic, but I don't actually think that's true. I mean, they were kind of alarmed because what happened is this was unique in that they sequenced the genome of the bacterium of the E. coli while the outbreak was actually going on. And this was highly unusual. And so they did this in 3 days. And so it provided everyone with a lot of information right away. And so, you know, scientists were looking at the genome and they were saying, oh, this bacterium has a lot of characteristics that we've never seen previously. We should be alarmed. But actually what happened is the genome provided a very useful tool for diagnostics. And so many individuals went through the genome, found unique portions that then they could use to screen food sources in Germany and identify patients more rapidly. And so it facilitated more rapid detection of the organism and eventually led to the discovery of fenugreek seeds as the culprit.
Was the genome sequence unraveled here at Michigan State, or did that take place elsewhere?
That took place in China.
Okay.
Somebody sent the DNA from a patient that they isolated from a patient to China, and they did that there. But we were one of the first here at Michigan State to actually get the strain to work on. And, you know, I was just lucky enough to have it fall into my lap. And so we just started working on it immediately to try to figure out whether it was more virulent than we've seen previously, or whether, I mean, another hypothesis was that maybe the patients or the people who were getting sick in Germany had a higher density of organisms on the foods that they were eating.
It's an important line of work you're in, but it's also so interesting because it's changing all the time.
It is.
That is just
keeps me in business.
It's an amazing topic. You're involved in a project as well called Classes Without Quizzes. Tell us about that.
I am. It's actually an interesting project. It's a few days of work. They have a bunch of lectures conducted by myself and other researchers at MSU. And so it's a really great way for alumni and other people who are affiliated with MSU to come and hear about what's going on at MSU.
This is science related, or
science
does it get
related
outside of science? It's all science. Okay.
It is. It's through the College of Natural Science.
Okay. Dr. Shannon Manning is an MSU molecular biologist. She'll be featured lecturer as part of MSU's Classes Without Quizzes, which is a chance for the public to engage with MSU researchers. Classes Without Quizzes will be held Saturday, April 13th, but registration is required. For more information and to register, you can go to NS, for natural science, ns.msu.edu. Dr. Shannon Manning, thank you and good luck.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. The 51st Ann Arbor Film Festival is underway, with most events at the Michigan Theater. The festival's long been a showcase for makers of independent and experimental films. Current State Scott Pohl spoke with Program Director David Dinnell about the Ann Arbor Film Festival's history and a couple of this year's highlights.
The festival started in 1963 by filmmaker George Manupelli, and he was involved with the art scene and kind of countercultural art happenings in Ann Arbor and around the University of Michigan. And it began as a forum for independent filmmaking. So artists that were working with film outside of any kind of studio system, and the festival is really just a platform for that, and it really has continued this way for the past 50 years. This is our 51st year. Obviously, the medium of film, you know, has evolved. The festival started to incorporate video and computer-generated digital works in the past decade, but also still shows a lot of 16mm film.
The festival has shown films by people like Andy Warhol in the past, and also some artists who went on to more mainstream careers like Gus Van Sant and George Lucas. Can you tell me what the festival has meant to the careers of some filmmakers?
Gus Van Sant, in particular, has said that the festival, you know, that Ann Arbor meant a lot because the festival had shown his earliest works. So these were really short films, you know, just a few minutes long. And, you know, he received encouragement that there was a place for this kind of filmmaking and for him to develop his own filmmaking into these feature-length works that he became better known for. And the same thing with George Lucas. I mean, his student film, THX 1138, like 17-minute version that he made when he was out there, had won awards when it showed at Ann Arbor, and then a few years later, he developed that into a feature-length film.
One of the weekend highlights for people who are listeners to public radio stations and viewers of public television stations would be the visit that Ken Burns has planned on Saturday to show and talk about the Central Park Five. That's coming to public TV stations next month, but people can see it early at the festival this year.
That's right. And in addition to just being able to see the film here, it's really going to be a special afternoon.
I want us to remember what happened that day and be horrified by ourselves.
Last night, a woman jogger was found unconscious and partially clothed in Central Park. She was beaten and sexually assaulted. Five youths were arrested at 96th Street, all between 14 and 15 years of age.
They got him!
A lot of people didn't do their jobs. Reporters, police, prosecutors, defense lawyers. This was institutional protectionism.
We falsely convicted them, and we walked away from our crime.
One of the five, one of the Central Park Five, Raymond Santana, is coming in from New York. And he was the youngest of the five at age 14 to be convicted in the Central Park jogger case, wrongfully imprisoned. He ended up being exonerated in 2002. So he'll be here on stage directly after the film with Ken Burns to talk about his experience. We'll talk about the film. We're also bringing in some legal experts on wrongful conviction that are working in that movement.
Tell me about one or two of the other weekend highlights on the schedule this year.
We have a visit from Susan Pitt. We're presenting two programs, so almost a complete retrospective of her 40 years of animation. She's maybe known more as a kind of cult animator. She's best known for her film Asparagus, which came out in the late 70s, but it really set people's imagination, really excited a lot of people when it came out, and has really influenced many generations of filmmakers. The first of her retrospective program is Thursday evening, and then the second will be Saturday.
David Dinnell is Program Director of the Ann Arbor Film Festival. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Agriculture is Michigan's second largest industry. With the exception of California, no other state produces such a diverse variety of fruits and vegetables. Michigan also has a large livestock industry. Over the years, the state has seen an expansion of so-called CAFOs, C-A-F-Os. Those are concentrated animal feeding operations. And in exchange for their high food product output, CAFOs also produce a lot of waste. Now, tonight, a panel discussion at Michigan State University will study the effect of CAFOs and the future of sustainable agriculture. I'm joined now by panelist and farmer Daniel Imhoff. He's the author of the book Food Fight. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure, our pleasure. Also with me, Maynard Beery, who runs Beery Farms of Michigan in Mason, Michigan. He's also a member of the Less Equals More Coalition, which is sponsoring tonight's forum. Hi, Maynard.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm under the impression both of you feel that there is a disconnect in our food system. Daniel Imhoff, can you explain what you mean?
Yeah, I think a lot of people may be under the impression that the price that we pay for our foods at the checkout counter include all of the real costs that go into that good. And I think our panel tonight will try to untangle many of the hidden costs of industrial agriculture that are really becoming big problems in the environment and communities where huge concentrations of animals are raised and with our public health in general.
This is an environmental cost in particular?
I would say it's an environmental and a public health cost, and also it's increasingly expensive for taxpayers because so much of our tax dollars go to support this type of agriculture.
Maynard Beery, give me your take on CAFOs then.
I guess I would agree with Dan. I think we should add social costs. I think the CAFO, the production agriculture, has not been positive for our small communities in terms of people. And certainly the CAFOs have some real environmental issues, as does production agriculture, continuous row crop, farming up and down the hills, mud running to the rivers. These are very negative things that are results. And I don't believe really paid for at the cash register at the grocery store.
Daniel, Maynard, do we know how many CAFOs there are in Michigan? Daniel?
I don't. I'm from California, so I'm not sure. I defer to Maynard and my panelists here at Michigan for that.
Okay. Maynard, any idea? Are they common?
Yes, they're common. In terms of numbers,
dozens, hundreds?
We're more in the thousands.
Thousands.
Yeah, when we start looking at feedlots, beef feedlots, hog facilities, chickens, dairy. Dairy is certainly a large one here in Michigan.
Dan Imhoff, is the primary justification of these larger operations cost cutting? Then do they end up meaning lower prices for consumers?
You know, it all depends on how you calculate those costs, because there are health costs, there are tax dollars, et cetera. For the operators of a CAFO, and it's important to note that a CAFO is really it's a definition from the Environmental Protection Agency. It deals with numbers of animals on a specific site and how much waste is coming out of that site, because they are pollution sources. So, you know, the CAFOs are really trying to spread their costs over huge numbers of animals whose lives are really relegated to almost machine, factory-like existences. And we're talking 2,000 hogs, 2,500 hogs in one barn, 5,000. In California, it's very common for a dairy to have 5,000 cows in a single area. And the cows never really are out on grass or pasture. They're just really milk-making machines. And so, you know, by spreading these costs, cramming these animals in, buying the cheapest feed that they can, and then finding places to distribute waste, where oftentimes regulators are looking the other way and really harming communities. That's the economic model that the CAFO is based on.
As a community, how vigorously are owners and operators of these CAFOs resisting change? Dan Imhoff?
Oh, they're resisting it at every level, from the communities that they identify to concentrate their agriculture to increasing attempts at the state level to make it illegal for someone to report and publish photos and document actual criminal animal abuse in these facilities with so-called ag gag laws or whistleblower intimidation laws.
Maynard Beery, tell us about your operation. You obviously are not an operator of a CAFO. Tell us how you go about farming.
My operation is a relatively small all grass-fed beef operation. It consists of about 100 animals, and these animals are outdoors 24/7, 365. They're rotated amongst pastures during the green season, during the winter season, such as now, why they are supplemented with dry feed, hay, that kind of thing.
How much do you know about CAFO operations here in Michigan then, Maynard?
Actually, I think a fair amount. I've worked with CAFOs in terms of my other businesses. I've visited operations. I can remember a tour that we did in a hog CAFO, and I am familiar with the dairy CAFOs, so I have a familiarity with how they operate and what their needs are. They're essentially based on cheap fuel, cheap energy, and that's been the key to their, you know, success to this point.
How is it, Dan Imhoff, how is it taxpayers subsidize CAFOs, and by how much do they do that?
Well, we have the U.S. Department of Agriculture is given its marching orders and its budget through the Farm Bill, and the Farm Bill is passed every 5 to 7 years. And a great deal of the commodity agriculture support that can be anywhere from, you know, $15 billion per year goes just to support farmers who are growing feed, corn, soybeans, cotton seed that heavily go into the livestock industry. But the Farm Bill also authorized conservation programs, and a very high percentage of a certain program called EQIP, Environmental Quality Incentive Program, goes to help CAFO operators with their manure storage and transportation costs, as well as the hard costs of farmers that grow feed to set up permanent irrigation systems. So taxpayers fund, and that's just at the federal level. There are all kinds of state programs and federal and local tax breaks that really support the CAFO industry.
Maynard Beery, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would concur with that. In other words, relatively in terms of dollars going to the small farm, the program is based on resource impact. And when you have 5 or 10 million gallons of animal waste in a lagoon, obviously your environmental impact is considerably greater than a herd of 50 or 100 cows that are out spreading the manure across the green pastures that they're consuming. Okay, it's hard for me to show a resource impact. Okay, well, yeah, I got to keep the cows out of the drain, but okay, beyond that, some fencing that's relatively cheap.
We've got to leave it there. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm sorry to say, Maynard Beery of Beery Farms in Mason, farmer Daniel Imhoff, author of the book Food Fight. They're part of a panel discussion tonight at Michigan State University on CAFOs. Tomorrow on the show, we'll learn about Lansing's new Financial Empowerment Center. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State.